Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It. I'm Jenna Flanagan, sitting in for Allison Stewart. A new documentary, Miles Davis, The Birth of the Cool, unpacks the life of a cultural icon who spent his entire career breaking musical boundaries. Veteran filmmaker, National Humanities Medalist, and MacArthur genius, Stanley Nelson, was granted full access to the Miles Davis estate and delivers viewers a portrait of Davis through never-before-seen archival footage, studio outtakes, and rare photos that demonstrate Davis's tireless pursuit to constantly innovate. The film opens at the Film Forum tomorrow. Stanley is joining me now in the studio, along with Miles Davis's nephew, Vince Wilburn Jr., who toured and recorded with Miles on many legendary recordings in the 80s. Stanley and Vince, welcome to All of It.
Thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. So, Stanley, I want to start with you and say that a lot of your past films tell a history that isn't often told. So what is it, as silly as it may sound, about the Miles Davis story that drew you in?
Well, one, I'm a big jazz fan, and, you know, I mean, I think there's no musician in the 20th century that compares with Miles. But also, you know, Miles is such an intriguing figure. It's not only his music, which in and of itself would be enough, but he's such a character, you know. He became an icon in a way that very few musicians become, especially jazz musicians. So he transcends the music, and I think he transcends so many different eras, so it allowed us to talk about so many different things besides music.
Of course. And I understand that this film was 15 years in the making?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we thought about, you know, 15 years ago and kind of put aside. But about 2 years ago, you know, we were approached by American Masters, and then we partnered with a company called Eagle Rock out of London, which is part of Universal Films, and we got the film made, and I'm just so happy we did.
Vince, before we get into the legend of your uncle, I just wanted to get a little bit of a personal narrative. What are some of your early memories of Miles Davis?
His sense of humor, an excellent chef, stylist, clothes, you know, he loved fast cars. But it was always about the music. He never sacrificed. He was a champion on you know, your craft, you know. Study your music, study your instrument. And he sacrificed a lot. When I say sacrifice, he sacrificed family, kids, you know, for the music.
Okay. Getting into Miles Davis, the person, and how we learn so much more about who he was, you were mentioning how he was so much about study the music, and we learned that, or at least I didn't know, that he was a student at Juilliard and that he was a very diligent student and was very dedicated to studying the craft.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was really important for us to portray in the film. You know, so many times, especially when we look at African American musicians, jazz musicians, or blues musicians, there's this sense that, you know, that, oh, they were just natural talents. You know, they picked up the instruments, they never practiced, they never learned. And so that was something that we really wanted to say in the film and show in the film, that, you know, Miles studied all music. Miles studied classical music, classical composing at Juilliard. You know, at the same time, he was playing down at 52nd Street with Charlie Parker, you know, jazz at night, studying at Juilliard in the day, and then he would take scores home, classical scores, music sheets home from Juilliard and study them all night long. And so, you know, that's who Miles was, and it shows in his music.
One of the other things that comes through in this film, of course, is the backdrop against the American backdrop, which Miles Davis's life, let's say, existed against. You were pretty honest about, you know, the world that he was born into, what it was like in East St. Louis.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Why was that important to make that crystal clear for the audience?
Well, I mean, I think it's important because, you know, Miles grew up wealthy, especially for an African-American born in 1926. His father was a dentist. You know, besides having a home in East St. Louis, they had a farm outside East St. Louis. He grew up with horses, riding his own horse. And that's who Miles was. But, you know, he wasn't immune from racism, the racism that existed in this country at that time, and especially in that part of the country. And that affected Miles. We see it over and over again in his life. You know, people ask, well, why is this guy angry? He had a lot of reasons to be angry.
Of course, and we see several examples between heartbreak and police brutality and things of that nature where, I can't remember who it was in the film, but they specifically say, you know, these things that happen to you when you're young, they stay with you.
Mm-hmm. That's Marcus Miller, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that the other another thing that we document in the film is, you know, right after Kind of Blue comes out, Miles takes a beating outside a club on 52nd Street. And Miles' name is right there in lights, you know, like right there. And a cop comes out and says, you know, you got to move on from standing out here. Miles says, you know, no, I'm smoking a cigarette. And he takes a beating, which is documented, you know, for us as filmmakers, you know, they're great photos of that and people who were there at the time. But, you know, and as Marcus says, you know, this affected him for the rest of his life, because, you know, again, Kind of Blue had just come out. He's the toast of the town. He's at the top, and he still, you know, is not immune from the racism of the United States.
There's a moment in the film, speaking of Kind of Blue, where right after Miles was assaulted, as you were saying, and that he really had such a hard time moving on from this, or at least struggled with it. Why is it that for someone who seemed to overcome or to, I mean, there were so many instances where it seemed as if Miles Davis was, I don't want to say bigger than the racial issues of the day, but that he seemed to keep them from infecting at least his music and maybe some of the ways he conducted his personal life. But why is it that it still stuck with him?
Well, I mean, I think one of the quotes that I love of in the film is someone's talking about Miles and they're saying that, you know, in his music, you know, which is so beautiful and so tender, that he was able to be a person that he wasn't able to be in you know, real life. I mean, you know, it's very hard for a black man in the United States to show tenderness. You know, it just is. I mean, it's not the world that we live in. And so, you know, Miles could show this other side of himself within his music. But he also, let's be clear, he also had that kind of, you know, gruff, you know, argumentative side that he showed to the public.
Well, speaking of tenderness, we see his trip to Paris and how that affected him. We get to see Miles falling in love, perhaps, you know, really for the first time. And Vince, I'm just wondering, as a family member, how do you think that Paris trip not only affected but then stayed with him?
Well, I mean, he loved to travel in Europe. I played with him too. I traveled and toured with him. He loved the way the European audiences were very attentive to the music, to the concerts, and since that first trip to Paris, I mean, it stuck with him. I mean, we always look forward to going to Europe, you know, not to talk about and downplay the U.S. audiences.
But it was just—he
said the food tastes different, the water's different, and he enjoyed Europe, enjoyed France. He was knighted in
France. That does feel like an overarching theme that we hear from a lot of African Americans, particularly from that time period, going to some place like Paris, coming back and being like, I can't with this anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the great things for us was we were able to interview Juliet Greco, who was the woman that he fell in love with in Paris, you know, in 1949, and so that was great. We should say that we have an actor, Carl Lumley, who kind of plays Miles or reads Miles' words. You know, we don't ever see Carl, but he kind of reads Miles' words, and you know, so it's like the film in some ways is narrated by Miles himself, and I think that's one of the things that's really fascinating for me about the film.
Having the actor narrate the film in Miles' voice. First of all, we learned the backstory for Miles' voice in Operation. But what was the importance of having that, not only having somebody narrate, but it wasn't just a traditional narrator, but somebody who could sound almost like Miles' voice?
Yeah. I mean, I think that in the last few films that I've made, we've tried to get away from using a standard narrator. And because Miles, you know, wrote an autobiography, because Miles did a lot of interviews the last 10 years or so of his life, we were able to take those and fashion a narrative out of Miles' own words. And so I thought it was really unique. And as Miles looked back on his life, He was very open about it, you know, and he was very telling. And so it adds another dimension, I think, to the film.
One of the things that I thought was interesting about him being very open was about his relationships and the mistakes that he made in his relationships. That's not something that we often hear, particularly about men who, for lack of a better description, are rock stars.
I mean, he was no angel. I mean, the one of the things I love about the film that Stanley directed and put together was they showed the humanistic side. You know, my uncle wasn't an angel, his brother says. You know, my other uncle Vernon says. So it's the humanistic side. It's the ups and downs, the drugs. The, you know, he's a human being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've seen it. I have to say it. I've seen it, and we've done Q&As about, for me personally, 22 times, and I cry, and it touches me every time I see it. You know, it's that type of film. I'm not saying it because Stanley's here.
Well, no, it really is.
It's my uncle, and every time I see it, it moves me.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we've traveled all over the world and screened it, and we were in South Africa, and the way it touched the musicians of South Africa and the people of South Africa was really moving to me. You know, they stuck around for the Q&As. No one filed out, and questions were moving, you know. And the effect that this, my uncle's been gone since September 28th, 1991, and the effect that he continues to have on the world is pretty amazing. And this film is like, phew.
Well, speaking of the effect that he continues to have on the world, this film also, and of course it has to, takes you through the incredible music that he produced. You both mentioned Kind of Blue, and I just want both of you to talk a little bit about why that was such a groundbreaking album.
There's nothing like it, you know, and you know, Joshua Redman, you know, the great saxophonist is in the film, and he has a great quote, which is something like, "Why is Kind of Blue kind of blue? Why is the Bible the Bible?" You know, it is what it is, you know, Kind of Blue is that album where, you know, I don't know what people will be doing or listening to 100 years from now, but I know that they'll be listening to Kind of Blue. You know, it's a kind of album where you can't imagine sitting down anybody and saying, listen to this, and them saying, I don't get it. I don't like it. And it's that rare thing where it is a work of genius, but it's accessible.
Mm.
You know, it's clearly a work of genius, but it clearly is accessible and it clearly is moving for everybody.
Vince, you got a chance to tour with him. what was it like being in his bands? Because you also learned that he was very much, which surprised me, was very open about allowing his musicians to go where the music takes you and just be you, is a phrase I kept hearing over and over.
One of the exciting things, you have a set list, right? And the set list is during the whole tour. But the songs that we played on the set list were different every night. And for me to listen to Miles, Uncle Miles, rephrase Human Nature or whatever song we were doing in the set list was amazing. And to see the effect that it had on the audiences all over the world. I mean, you had to be there to see it. And he had this wireless mic, so he would go, you know, you could feel the eyes follow him around the stage, along the stage, you know, and he was prancing around and playing with us. Still, you know, it's moving.
Well, of course, we get a chance to see some of that as the film goes into his later work, as he embraced funk, and then, of course, later in the 80s. And what was it about his ability to not just create sounds, but to recreate sounds? Because again, like his playing Human Nature or various other like pop songs of the day that he took and completely made his own.
I mean, I think one thing about Miles is, you know, he was an original, and that was something that you know carried through all his music, you know, whenever it was. And that Miles, you know, he changed, and that was what music was to him. It was change, and Miles embodied that. His music just changes constantly, and not for the sake of change. That's what I love about it. You know, so there'll be, you know, you listen to a jazz album, and it's almost like the musician said, "Oh, well, let's do a Brazilian, you know, and now let's do a blues." But Miles was committed to whatever he was doing, and he wasn't doing it because an executive said, you know, what about this? Miles believed in what he was doing, and he was always all in, you know. It was like he was jumping in head first, and he was in there.
Well, even when I believe there was one of the record labels, one of his first labels, he wanted to leave and he still owed them several albums or right. something like that. Yeah. He was like, all right, let's everybody get in the studio. We're just going to go.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be something that he was completely comfortable with, which I just found so fascinating comparing it to some of the more contemporary musicians of my day, you know, like Prince or somebody like that. I don't think Prince would ever have let his musicians do whatever they wanted to, but Miles Davis did.
He was one of the artists that, one of the only artists who would let the tape run, because he said there were always songs inside of songs. And so you would record for 2 days, 3 days straight, and then he would pick pieces out of the tapes, you know, that he loved.
Yeah, one of the great things, you know, for me in the film was we had access to those kind of sessions. So yeah. So we have the tape running sessions. So we mm-hmm. have Miles kind of, there's a great sequence in the film where they're constructing a piece, you know, with the band. I mean, you hear them in the studio say, well, what about this? What about that? What about this? What about that? You know, as they're constructing, you know, this piece. And so because we had access to Sony's archives, we were able to kind of use that stuff within the film.
Somewhere in the film, and I can't remember exactly where, but in an interview from with Miles, you hear that he was in a classroom, I believe, in Juilliard, and one of the teachers was sort of talking about, you know, comparing perhaps jazz to blues or something along those lines, but he basically called out the teacher for suggesting that, I believe it was the blues, was indicative of slave music and of the downtroddenness of the African-American experience. Now, I'm not going to repeat what it was that he said. We can't do that on the radio. But I do just want to sort of circle back to, he seemed to have the spirit, which just seems so profound, particularly for the time and space that he lived in, to be that person to say you don't know what you're talking about in a much more colorful way to an authority figure.
Right. Well, he's 19 at that point, you know, when he calls out the teacher. And it's a great story. And it's also great because it's told by Wayne Shorter, who's, you know, just an incredible musician. And just to, you know, have Wayne tell that story. But that was Miles, you know. And this is at the time where Miles is not only at Juilliard, you know, by day, but he's playing with Charlie Parker at night. So, you know, just an incredible life that Miles lived. I should say that you know, I'm just so happy that the film is premiering tomorrow here in New York, because, you know, New York is my hometown. And although we've gone around the country and around in some places around the world, mm-hmm. you know, with the film, it hasn't played in New York. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're like really just excited to kind of unleash this film, you know, on New York. Finally, we held it back from screening at festivals and things in New York because we knew we wanted to premiere, you know, at Film Forum in New York, and for that to be the premiere. So it's really exciting for us to do this.
No, it absolutely makes you want to almost, if you will, revisit that 52nd Street in the late 40s, early 50s, et cetera, and see just all those amazing musicians who just happened to be playing at the club at the time.
Yep. Yeah, and one of the things that I love about the film is also that we go, you know, through the 70s and 80s with Miles, that we don't stop at kind of blue. You know, we talk about Bitches Brew, which is a hysterical segment in the film, you know, that he just wanted to call this album Bitches Brew, you know, and Columbia Records, how they reacted to that. But you know, we felt it was really important to talk about the later Miles, you know, that Miles' music did not end with Someday My Prince Will Come, that it went on and that it was revolutionary, mm-hmm. You know, through On the Corner and those other albums.
Well, the film is also incredibly brave in that it does take us to the darker parts of Miles, and we learn a lot, not just about his drug habit, but also about the domestic abuse that he witnessed and that he was guilty of exacting on partners. Why was that important to include?
Well, that was part of Miles' life, you know, and I think it was really important that we include, and that's who Miles was, you know. And in some ways, that's one of the things that makes it interesting as a filmmaker, you know, because that's this character, you know. It's not this guy, it's not this saint, you know. It's this guy who's very, very complicated, and I think it was really important for us to talk about that. I think one of the things about the domestic abuse is that, you know, his first wife, Frances, who's in the film, who has since passed away, unfortunately, Frances is just so incredible in the film that it kind of, she's so resilient. She's just so wonderful and hilarious and beautiful and resilient that in some ways it helps us as filmmakers, mm-hmm. because, you know, she bounces back.
Absolutely. And you know, the next guy who got her was lucky. Yeah. She says, or no, as she says, that Miles says about her when they eventually broke up. We also get a chance to see his other artistic side with drawing and painting. Mm-hmm. And how did that come into his life?
He had a minor stroke, and so to get the feeling of his hand again, mm-hmm. the doctor suggested for him to sketch and to write. I mean, to paint. And so he started off with a sketchbook, then the sketchbook on the plane or in the studio, sketching. Then that progressed to canvas, and I was the paint runner when I lived in Malibu. And so people started admiring his work, and then he started having a gallery, showings, and people started paying money for these paintings. I remember Lionel Richie came over and bought a painting. So the more people wanted the paintings, Uncle Miles would he'd hang them up and call and say, "Quincy, I got another painting."
George Ween tells us a great story that's actually not in the film. We didn't include it, but George Ween, he gave George Ween a painting, and then when the painting started selling for a lot of money, he went and got it back. Miles said, "You gotta give me the painting back." And so Miles takes the painting back. But then, in typical Miles fashion, you know, a couple of years later, Miles gives him two pictures and to replace the one.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. Wrapping up, I do want to say that, and it's also said in the film that one of Miles' albums, if you listen to it, you can clearly hear the blueprint for hip hop as we know it today. Mm-hmm. And it very much feels like watching this film that Miles lived his life as the blueprint for some of the rap stars that we know and love today. Where do you see, especially you, Vince, where do you see echoes of Miles existing in popular culture now?
I mean, it's just, I say this in some interviews, I've stated this in interviews. I've never been around anybody who changed clothes six times a day, five, six times. I mean, that's just what he did. And he said, I said, "Uncle Miles, why do you change clothes so much?" He said, "I'm just rehearsing." You know, so I mean, that type of mind, you know, never complacent, never to look back, always looking forward. And I think that the world needs more of that, you know. Evolving, forever evolving, you know, because that's what we need. That's what he was about, and Stanley just captured this. And when I look at it, I just miss him so much because, you know, it's hard to fit a man's career, Uncle Miles' career, in a short time like that you have for a movie, but Stanley did it, and it's just so moving, you know. And I hope people can get a chance to see this and witness this.
All right. Well, definitely go out and see the film. Absolutely.
Please, really.
And if nothing else, when you leave this film, you're going to want to purchase, if you don't already have, a Miles Davis album. And I believe we have some Freddie Freeloader that we can leave the audience with. I've been speaking with Stanley Nelson Jr. and Vince Wilburn Jr. about the new documentary, Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool. Thanks for joining us on All of It.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.